Ecclesiastes 9. Since last week, I was saying that we were looking at Solomon's tips. Solomon had come to a few conclusions about what life was about, and he had some tips for navigating life. In other words, if you take this course, it's probably the path of least resistance. It's probably the path that is, you know, the wisest, because, you know, there are other ways that can lead into big trouble. And he pauses to reflect on that at the start of this chapter. So he's looking back at the last part of chapter 8. He's looking back and summing it up and thinking, okay, if this is the case, if the best thing a man can do is enjoy his life, if there's a real sense that eventually there will be some form of judgment against the wicked, it's better to go God's way rather than one's own way, where does that leave me? Where does that leave me? Because he also concluded there was a bit of a mystery to it all as well. Verse 17, then I saw all that God had done. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Despite all his efforts to search it out, man cannot discover its meaning. Even if a wise man claims he knows, he cannot really comprehend it. Now, if we're honest about ourselves, we know that. We won't come through life and have everything laid out in a way that's neat and tidy. We won't claim to know everything. We won't claim to have done everything. There'd be stuff we can't comprehend. Now, some of you know that I'm rather taken with ancient mythologies. And one of the things I find, one of my favourite bits of literature is this ancient Babylonian tale, the Epic of Gilgamesh. And Gilgamesh, just to sort of get to the gist of it, he's got a bit of a problem, really. He's a demigod. He's semi-divine. Now, his problem is this. Everything about him's heightened. You know, whatever he does it with such zeal. He does it with such fervour that basically he builds cities. He, you know, does this. He makes love to women. Everything like that. And he wears out all his courtiers and everything. But he's not satisfied. He's not satisfied. So he goes on a quest. And rather touchingly at the end, when the mysteries he is after are in his grasp, he loses them. And it's a bit of a metaphor which we have in this passage. Death takes everyone. He's semi-divine. He's not fully divine. He still lacks the knowledge of the divine. And that's really what is concluded here. All share a common destiny, verse 2. You know, in a sense, you know, whether righteous, whether wicked, everything is in God's hands. And everyone will end up the same. We're all going to die. Now, I don't want to bring a downer on this sunny day, but I had a birthday the other day. And one of the things I know, and I can say with absolute confidence, I don't think I'm being morbid about it, there's a lot less years ahead than there are behind. That's just a fact of life. And Solomon actually is bringing us down to earth with a bit of a bump here, but he knows what men, women are. Even boys and girls can be like this. One of the things that was coming more and more apparent, if you asked a child a few years ago, I dare say it's the same today, because of the culture we now live in. You know, when I was a kid, someone said, what do you want to be when you grow up? Which was quite interesting. I went for a period where I actually wanted to be a clergyman, and now I ended up being one, so there you are. But, you know, they say something like, I want to be a farmer, or, you know, I want to be this. What do they say today? I want to be famous. Because fame's what it's all about. Everything's out there. To be there and done that. These people were held up to have marvellous lives, so you want to be famous. But Solomon says, well, won't do you much good, not in the long run. In the long run, you're going to end up the same. If you're good, you're bad. If you're very, very religious, you're devoted to a religion or whatever it is, you're going to end up the same. Everyone has the same destiny. This is an evil in everything that happens under the sun. Now, that verse I think we need to take carefully. What is he saying here? Because you can look at this and misinterpret this. Some of what we're seeing in the book of Ecclesiastes is that God is distant. Now, I think Solomon's done that for a purpose, because he's really trying to sort of reflect from a human point of view. He's not invoking Yahweh, the covenant name of God. He's using the word Elohim, Lord Creator. And the point is this. There has been a curse put on man. We saw that right at the start of the book. Let me remind you. If you can't quite think of what I'm thinking of here. It is that Solomon set out to look at everything by wisdom. Chapter 1, verse 13. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom. And he was a wise guy. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. What is he talking about? Well, you're probably preempting what I'm going to say. It's a Genesis 3 world. Yes. There is a burden on man. God's put it on there. God actually warned man about it. He told them that if they went their own way, there would be consequences. And they have the burden of the curse. They have the burden. This is evil that God has not put on man. This is man. This is what man has done, and this is where he ends up. And what, of course, was a nature of the curse? Well, part of it was this. We're in a dying world. We die. The world will die. The world will wear out. That's where it's going to leave us in the long run. And Solomon, as he does, stands back and sort of puts a spotlight on this by saying, well, whatever you do, whether you're very religious, whether you're doing, this is where you're going to end up. So death is a great leveller. It's interesting, in verse 3 he uses this phrase which I found very interesting. The hearts of men, moreover, this is the second part of the verse, are full of evil, and there is a madness in their hearts while they live. What does he mean by that? Well, hopefully we'll come to that in a second, because I think he clarifies it a bit more later. And he sort of sees that if death is the one thing we can be certain of, then death gives life its real value. Solomon was a good one for Proverbs. He knew a lot. He wrote a lot. And he gives us a little one here. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. We probably get the gist of that. But to fully understand it, if you look at the ancient culture, I mean, particularly Babylonian culture in the ancient Near East, lions were very, very much sort of seen as an artistic ideal. They were the big, strong creature that was to be admired. You know, they hunted, they did what they wanted, they took what they wanted. Dogs were despised. Dogs were they were filthy within the Jewish setting. Anyway, they were seen as unclean. But pretty much in all the ancient Near East. And you can see now what Solomon's saying. Well, a filthy, you know, live dog, that does much better than a dead lion. Dead lion can't do much. Might have been great while it's alive, but now it's dead. Dog's got something going for it, whatever that may be. So he's basically saying there is hope while we are alive. And this is the focus. The focus is not just now there's hope because you're going to get a bit of enjoyment out of life, but there's a hope that counterbalances the fact that we're all going to die. You can't change after you're dead. I remember Woody Allen summing up at the end of his film Love and Death. He said, don't see death necessarily as an end, but see it as a very good way of cutting down your expenses. There's some truth in that. Well, his point is, you can't do much, can you, if anything. But if you're living, you can get stuff done. And this is the remarkable thing. He goes to a familiar refrain here in verse 7. Go eat your food with gladness, drink your wine with a joyful heart, for it is now God favours what you do. Now, hold on a second, we're saying. Didn't you say, Solomon, it didn't quite matter whether we were very religious or whether we were devout or whether we were filthy reprobate? No, that's not what he's saying. He's just saying they all end up the same. He's saying now is the chance of God's favour. There is a chance to do something, and you might even enjoy it. You see, we've got to look at this in the context of what he said just back in chapter 8. In chapter 8, he concluded this, verse 12. Although a wicked man commits 100 crimes and still lives a long time, I know it will go better with the God-fearing men who are reverent before God. So now God favours what you do. You have a chance. There's a real chance for change. And I think that's very, very important, and we understand that. Isaiah 61 really captures this, doesn't it? This picture of the Lord's favour. And it's, of course, these are the verses that Jesus quoted when he was in the synagogue. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has appointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release from darkness the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour, and a day of vengeance for our God, to comfort all who mourn. You see, the point was this. That's clearly pointing towards Jesus Christ, isn't it? But the point is this. There's always time. There's always time where God's favour might be gained. Now, we know that's gained through grace, through Christ. But there's a sense while we're alive, God favours what we do. The question is, what are we going to do with that? Are we going to do it for good? Or are we going to reject him? You see, one of the things, and I think more and more I look at this, and I found Ecclesiastes a perplexing and fascinating book, but I've also found it a very intriguing book, is that he is saying that the living of life is our worship. He's seen it, the phrase he uses, it's from the hand of God. So we better acknowledge that. Whatever enjoyment, whatever wholesome enjoyment can be derived, well, that is from God. Look at what he says here again. He's just saying, look, aim to have it good. Enjoy your food and drink. Earlier on in the book, he's talked about work. Work can be good. It can be fun. Marriage. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love all the days of this meaningless life. What's he saying by that? Well, so much is meaningless in life is this word, as we said before, Hebel. There's a lot about life you can't grasp onto, but here's some tangible stuff. Hebel's like mist, it disappears. It looks solid, but when you get there, you can't really gather up an armful of it, can you? You can't. But here's things God gives. and work at it. Whatever your hands finds to do, do it with all your might. Verse 10, for in the grave where you're going, there is neither working, nor planning, nor knowledge, nor wisdom. You will not change your spiritual state there. Not at all. It will be too light. Now, I think actually there's a major issue for us here, and I think it's an issue for Christians particularly. No, it's not just about acknowledging God. Yes, it is, but there's more to it than that. And I don't want you to mishear me. I'm going to use some verses, so hopefully you won't be confused by this. But can you see what Solomon's saying? I don't think he's saying it's wrong to plan. But he's saying this. Live in the moment. Live in the moment. One of the things that strikes me is how we can procrastinate as Christians. Earlier on, I said that Solomon had talked about the hearts of men are full of evil and there is madness. And you know what I think he's thinking of there is the big ambition. No wrong with having ambitions if they're God-given, if they're guided by God. No harm to plan for the future. But don't let it obsess you. There's a lot, you know, a number of people I've come across in my life who talked about times. I remember I was at a post office. There was a guy who's always working overtime. And he said, well, I said, why do you do all this stuff? You look sort of like it's running you ratty. Oh, well, I just need this for the family. I just need that for the family. I'm just going to get something else for him. And then I'll be able to ease off. And I said, I don't think you'll ever be able to ease off. You won't ease off. There'll be something else you need. There's a real sense, I think, in these verses of be content. There's a danger, isn't there? Solomon's warned about looking back too much. But here he warns of looking forward too much or getting an incorrect balance. In Haggai's time, Haggai 2, one of the first feast days they would have had, they were all milling around, I suppose, after whatever they did at the feast. And they looked at the temple as they prepared to build. It was great. They were going forward. The Spirit of the Lord had stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel. The people were honouring God. There was a lot of good going on. And they looked at the foundation. And I dare say, some of those people who remembered Solomon's temple with all its grandeur said, oh, look. It's not going to be a patch on Solomon's temple, and everyone's spirit and everyone's enthusiasm went from about here down to here. We can do that, can't we? You can look back to the glory days of this church when it was full. And yet we're still called to do the same thing, aren't we? We're called to take the message out now. It's not changed. What we're here for hasn't changed. We mustn't look back. We mustn't also have ambitions which are not God-given. Yes, we must look to the future, but we must do it. We must understand our reasons for it. It must really be about one thing, and that's about honouring God, isn't it? And even if we have those ambitions, the work goes on now. Stony still needs to be reached. In case anyone hasn't noticed, they're not flocking in here on a Sunday, are they? It may take time, it may take years. May not happen in my time, I don't know. That's for the Lord to decide. But we are to be people, even if we are working towards something for the Lord, we are people of the here and now. And we are to live in the moment. See, I think this is really where Paul's coming from. Paul, in Colossians 3, I have this on my study wall. It's a great verse. Colossians 3, It's looking at this. It's looking, it's taking this idea. Verse 23. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men. Since you know you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward, it is as is the Lord Christ you are serving. So go at it. Work hard at it. Honor God by your work. Whatever it is, wherever God puts you. As long as it's not immoral, as long as it's not against God's word, it's service to Him. Enjoy life, even when it's perplexing. And live your life for God in here and now. So that's not a bad place to end, really, is it? But the trouble is, as we said before, Solomon then pulls the rug a bit from under our feet. Or at least he makes us sort of stutter a bit here. There's a but, and it's a big but. Life doesn't always neatly add up. And that's something we know if we've been paying attention in Ecclesiastes. Solomon looks on life and he sees a game of chance in some ways, or it appears to be. I don't know about you, but did you ever be... this is the kind of thing, and it's been taken out of context. It's the kind of thing they used to say at, you know, grammar school or private school sports days, or race is not to the swift, to make basically the kids that lost a race feel better. You know, the race is not to the swift, the battle is not to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favour to the learned. But time and chance happen to them all. And of course, it's always done in the sort of sense, well, you know, you keep going, you pick yourself up and going, keep going. But actually, what Solomon's doing here is saying, no, I just want to make a point. Life is terribly random. It's terribly random. And to be honest, in case you haven't got it, you don't know what's around the corner. Verse 12. Moreover, no man knows when his hour will come. As fish are caught in a cruel net, or birds taken in a snare, so men are trapped by evil times that unexpectedly fall upon them. After all, we're a result of the curse, aren't we? We're a result of man's sin. It's a Genesis 3 world, in case we hadn't noticed. So there's this sense, isn't there? There's a random element. You may suffer a change of fortune in the future. And even, and Solomon was wise, even if wisdom is useful, you can't even depend on that. It's one of these passages, this little passage where you get this poor man who saves the city from his wisdom. Commentators go into sort of pages about whether actually it happened or whether it's just sort of a little parable made up for the time. Do you know, I don't think it matters. I think it's just a splendid illustration to illustrate what Solomon is saying. So we'll imagine this story. There was a poor man, but he was wise. And, you know, a king came upon us against a city, right? It was overwhelmed, looked like curtains for them. And this wise man, he just had some brilliant strategy. And he saved the day. But nobody remembered him. He wasn't in a position of influence. And so Solomon draws a conclusion, verse 16. So I said, wisdom is better than strength, but the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are no longer heeded. Yes, it looks like life is an unfair lottery. Even wisdom has its shortcomings in a Genesis 3 world. So what's his conclusion in the end? Well, his conclusion is that wisdom has some real value. Verse 17, the quiet words of the wise are more to be heeded than the shout of the ruler of fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroy as much good. If it was an actual event, I just wonder whether that the words of the poor wise man were the words that managed to bring peace or sue a truce or something like that. I just wonder whether that's a reflection on what the wise man did, because Solomon doesn't go into details about it. But it still makes the point, doesn't it? It's, in a sense, it's one of Solomon's tips again. If we're going to live in a life that's random and difficult, here's the path of least resistance. Now, wisdom does have real value. Apply yourself to wisdom. Wisdom should be listened to, and, of course, God's wisdom particularly. But in the end, sin damages wisdom. The only real wisdom we see is the wisdom of God. So what are we to do? Well, I want to draw two conclusions based on this. One based on what we do in life, and one based on how we are to respond to the thought that one day we will die. And the first one is this, Matthew 6, 25 to 27. Jesus' words about living in the moment in a godly way. Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you eat, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more important than food? And the body more important than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or stow away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they are? Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his life? Now, actually, that's stunningly to the point, isn't it? We can't. We can't prolong our life. We are in a position, really, where we are to either be completely fatalistic and just accept the way as the cards fall or are dealt, as it were, or we look to God in that and have a confidence in him, because he will not let us down. The second thing is this: how are we to respond in the light of death? Well, Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 27. If we're all going to die, what does that mean? Just as man is destined to die once and after that face judgment, as I said, there's the third fact of life, the third constant, the thing we know we can't escape. It's not just death and taxes, it's judgments as well. But here's the good news. So Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many peoples. He will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. You see, now actually, while we're alive, there's this God's favour. There's time to do something about a time when we will have no more time and we will not be able to pursue any course at all. That is absolutely essential. It's well known, isn't it, how they survived, I don't know, but the Rolling Stones were a pretty hedonistic bunch back in the 70s. So there was one telling song on their album, It's Only Rock and Roll, and it's the song Time Waits for No One. And it has many interesting lines in it. One of them, hours are like diamonds, don't let them waste. And the chorus is, as time waits for no man, no favours has he. Time waits for no man and he won't wait for thee. And that's reflective, isn't it? I don't know whether amongst all the debauchery and whatever there was a stunning moment of clarity for Mick Jagger or Keith Richards one day. I don't know. But it's certainly a telling. It's pure. It's, in a sense, it's pure Ecclesiastes. This is why I think Ecclesiastes is such a brilliant book. And this is why it's a great book to bring unbelievers to, because it actually answers those unbelievers' questions, doesn't it? There's a very interesting, Bill Wyman, the bass player of the Rolling Stones, did a book recently of photographs. There's a very interesting photograph in it of Mick Jagger with his then wife. And he's reading the Bible. It's just in an off moment in between time. And it said, well, that's interesting. Mick Jagger reading the Bible. The reporter who's interviewing said, well, yeah, I think he's trying to hedge his bets. And there's a sense like that, isn't there? We don't talk about death. Death is very taboo because we don't want to bring it up. We don't want to ruin a sunny day. But Solomon looks death straight in the eyes. He says, we're all going to be there one day. It's the one thing we can't avoid. It's about how we live now in relation to God. Let's pray.